Seth is born, one of Adam's sons. And then we're going to go down like this. From 130 years, we jump all the way down in Genesis chapter 5. This is where we find all the stuff out. In 5, Genesis chapter 5, we've got 130 years there. Then the next son is born 235 years after creation. Then the next one 325 years. The next one 395 years and so on and so forth to Noah. Noah is an important point because we're going to talk about his story. Noah is born 1,056 years after creation. Are you with me? So, here's the deal. You can go from zero at creation and count the years like that. We do it the other way when we come to a timeline. We do the BC thing. You know, you guys know what BC is, right? Before Christ, right? So we're going backwards from Christ, backwards, and then AD is what happens after Christ, okay? So BC, we go back, and if you take BC back by biblical timeline, you get to 3,950 BC is where creation took place, right in there somewhere, okay? And so, by the time we get to Noah, we've traveled 1,056 years from creation, and we're at 2894 BC. All right, you with me so far? Okay, from Noah, the flood we'll talk about in a minute, the flood takes place, and then there is a whole bunch of stuff that takes place after the flood. There's a story we're going to look at, and we get all the way to Abraham, and Abraham is born 1,949 years after creation. Okay, which is in 2001 BC. So how many years is that from zero to 1,949? That's right, 1,949 years. You thought I was doing it backwards, didn't you? You're like, oh, we got to calculate that. No, so BC 2001 or 2001 BC is when Abraham takes place. And we're going to run right now through the story that starts right after Adam is on the planet, and we're going to run all the way to Abraham because this part of the story has specific significance to the rest of humanity. So let's jump back to Genesis chapter 3, and we're going to go from Genesis chapter 3. Now I'm going to ask you a favor. Since I'm running on this one through 2,000 years and 12 chapters, you hold on to your Bibles, all right? We're going to be going from 3, and we're going to be moving forward. But I'm not going to do a whole lot of reading in there. I'm just going to be pointing. That's kind of in this chapter, and that's kind of in this chapter. You with me? And so you can go home this afternoon and read through Genesis chapter 3 through Genesis chapter 11, and all of this is in there. I'm just going to work you through as quickly as we can through this because we've got to get through. Now, Genesis chapter 3, a fascinating thing happens. This is what the Bible terms the fall of man. It is the beginning of everything that kind of influences our life today. Satan, who is the angel that fell, we call him by the name of Satan. Lucifer is another name that he's known by. The morning star is another name that he was known by in the Bible. Satan is on our planet, and Adam and Eve are in the garden that God created for them, and they commune with God on a face-to-face basis. God comes down, he walks with them, he hangs out with them, they chat, they talk. God told them something incredibly important because God created us as human beings very different from the way that he created everything else in his creation in terms of this planet, relative to this planet. He created us with the ability to create, the ability to think, the ability to choose, the ability to have choice, the ability to love. And so love is one of those intangible things, but love by definition is something that if it's tied directly to instinct, it's no longer love. It's just instinct. But if it's something that's tied to choice, then it becomes that wonderful intangible thing we call love. Okay? So here's the deal. God creates us with the ability to love him as he loves us. And in that creation, he tells us something incredibly important because in order to understand our relationship with him, he begins in Genesis chapter 2 and Genesis chapter 3 showing us how this relationship works. This relationship that we have with God is based on trust. And so he says to Adam and to Eve, listen, here's the deal. This garden is yours. It's yours to do with whatever you want. Everything I've created is yours. You have freedom to eat and enjoy and have fun. But I have created something in the garden, and it is a very special tree. And this tree, this particular tree, holds in it something that deals with me. And I want you to do something for me. I want you to leave the tree alone, okay? Because that tree holds in it death. Once you eat of the tree, then death will come into your family, okay? So Adam and Eve go, that's cool, no problem. Remember, Adam and Eve did not have at this point they had not been tainted by sin yet. So all of us sitting here, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking like a human being with sin in your life. You're going, oh man, come on. I mean, if God goes to me and goes, don't touch the tree, you know what you do, right? You're like, oh, I didn't die. That's great. See, because it's our natural instinct with sin tied into our lives that when we're told not to do something, that our natural instinct is to kind of rebel. We have to fight that natural instinct, right? Adam and Eve didn't have to do that. Their choice was free of sin. Their choice was all about God. So Adam and Eve spent their time in the garden not even thinking about the tree. No problem. If God says that's the case, we trust God. Of course we do. We don't question that. And so we go along, we have this incredible life. Look at what God has done. And one day, while Adam and Eve are hanging out in the garden, the Bible tells us in chapter 2 that a serpent comes up to Eve and starts chatting with her. And it tells us that the serpent, when he came up to Eve, was the enemy of God. Taking the form of a serpent, Satan comes up to Eve and says, listen, what did God say about the tree? And Eve goes, oh, he told us not to touch it, not to eat of it. And Satan's like, why? Well, because God said we can't touch the tree because it's dangerous and we'll die. And Satan goes, oh, you won't die. You won't die. In fact, I'll tell you why God told you not to touch the tree. He's holding you back. He's holding you back. See, God knows that if you eat of the tree, you will know all things like he knows all things. And so he's holding you back. Have you heard this one before? He's just trying to keep you from having fun. Have you heard that before? I mean, you read the Bible and it's like, oh man, God tells me all the stuff I'm not supposed to do. He's just trying to keep me from having any fun whatsoever. God is the joy killer. And that's exactly the same lie that started right there in the garden. God is out to kill your joy. God is out to keep you from the potential that you have. God is out to limit you. God is out to keep you in a place where he has control. And that's what Satan told Eve. And after he told Eve, Eve said, you don't understand. There are consequences if we step in. If I touch the fruit, I'm going to die. And Satan goes, oh, if you touch the fruit, you're not going to die. Go ahead and touch it. Touch it. And Eve goes, all right. Bloop. I didn't die. And Satan goes, see? See? God's a liar. He lied to you. God did not say if you touch the fruit, you're going to die, but Satan starts twisting everything around. And before you know it, poor Eve is standing there going, well, I mean, I can know everything. I can be like God, and this is incredible. And he's limiting me. And I mean, if I touch it, I didn't die. I can eat it and it won't die. I mean, what if? What if this is right? What if this is true? And so she takes a piece of the fruit and she eats the piece of fruit. And then she goes to her closest companion, Adam. And the Bible suggests in chapter 3 of Genesis that Adam was not the innocent bystander where, you know, Eve came up and said, try this. Here, I found it on a tree in the garden. It's really good. And he ate it and was like, oh, sin, no. It didn't play out like that at all. The Bible says to us in Genesis that Adam knew exactly what was going on the whole time. And so Adam and Eve start conversing. And what if God lied to us? What if he's trying to limit us? And so Adam eats the fruit as well. And the Bible tells us that sin enters into the world. The knowledge of good and evil come into Adam and Eve. And everything changes in that moment in history. At that moment, Adam and Eve begin to feel things they've never felt before. They begin to feel things like shame. How many of you love feeling shame in your life? I don't think anyone here likes to feel shame. They begin to feel embarrassed. They begin to feel things like that. And so the first thing they do is they cover themselves because they realize they're naked. Isn't that amazing? And so they go and hide. Now, look what they do. Next instinct. This is what sin does. Sin's key in life is to destroy and to alienate. That's what sin does. Destroy and alienate. It is its single-minded process. Alienate and destroy. Alienate and destroy. And so God comes into the garden, and where are Adam and Eve? They're hiding behind a bush. They're like hiding from God. Because you remember, in their context, when God entered the garden, it was a tangible thing for them. So just like you and me would assume, if well, God's in the garden, he's looking around for me, I bet we can hide from him. So they're hiding back behind God, and God goes, Adam, Eve, where are you? And finally he bumps into them, and he goes, what happened? And there it is. We ate of the tree, we sinned, and in Genesis chapter 3, God steps in and goes, I told you that the consequences of this is going to lead to death. And so now the process begins. The process of death has just begun. And so we find in Genesis chapter 3 that God speaks unto Adam and Eve the consequences of what's going to happen. They move out of paradise that God created for them, out of the garden, and God puts an angel to guard the entrance of the Garden of Eden so that no one can walk back into paradise and no one can walk back into where God has the tree and all of that wonderful stuff that he created. And Adam and Eve walk out, and then they begin their process as human beings tainted by sin, and sin begins its process of destruction right there and then. So Adam and Eve, coming into chapter 4, we find out that they have children. Okay, Adam and Eve start doing exactly what two people in love would do. They start doing what God intended them to do. They start procreating, and two kids are born, Cain and Abel. Okay, two boys, Cain and Abel. And Eve says, God has helped me have sons. And then we begin to see what happened when sin entered the planet. Okay, Cain and Abel are now two brand new human beings. They're born, and they start hanging out. And before you know it, this is what begins to happen. Abel comes to God, and he presents to God a sacrifice in chapter 4 that is pleasing to God. Cain presents a sacrifice that is not pleasing to God. He does not follow what God told him. Now remember, we are still in a point in history here where God talks to people directly, okay? He shows up just like he did in the garden, and he talks to them. They're not reading it out of a book. They're listening to him. He's conversing with them. We find out in chapter 4 that God comes to Cain, and he asks him questions, and he has a conversation with him like you and I would have with each other. So Cain and Abel present their sacrifices. God goes, Abel, I'm pleased. Cain, you've got to trust me, buddy. You've got to do it my way. See, there it is. You've got to do it my way, not yours. And Cain gets ticked. He gets mad, and he's like, how come you're getting on me instead of Abel? And God says to him in chapter 4, listen. Abel did what was right. You didn't. It's really simple. You do what's right, and I'll be pleased. You do what's wrong, and I won't. Here's why. Because this all comes back down to the original problem. You either trust me or you don't. If you trust me, you'll do what I say. If you don't trust me, you won't. And if you don't trust me and you don't do it my way, it's going to lead to death. Now, God doesn't say all that in chapter 4, but that's basically the point here. Do it my way, Cain, and I'll be pleased. So you know what Cain does? He does the next best thing. He gets mad at Abel, tells him, let's go in a field, buddy. Let's go hang out together. We're brothers. They go out in the field, and he kills Abel. Kills him. So he comes back just like his mom and dad, and God goes, Cain, where were you? Oh, I was hanging in the field, just chilling out. Where's Abel? Where's Abel? Do I look like Abel's keeper? Do I look like I'm supposed to know where he is? He's his own man. He does his own thing. Why are you asking me where Abel is? What do I look like? He's babysitter? Read it. It's basically what he says in so many words, all right? He says, I'm not my brother's keeper. And God looks at him and goes, you idiot. Okay, he doesn't say that, but that's exactly what I would have said if I were there. Because again, we're back to humanity assuming that God doesn't know, you know? It's like, I can hide this from you. And he goes, Cain, Abel's blood is crying out to me from the field in which you killed him. Once again, you are going down the same path, doing it your way, and look what it's doing. Blood is being spilled, death and destruction and alienation is occurring. And then Cain, at that point, is moved out, and he's sent away. And God once again does exactly what he had to do with Cain's parents, which is basically cast him further and further away. Because God is beginning to show us that the path of destruction is the path of doing it our way, right? So then, in chapter 5, as we work our way through, in chapter 5, we find out that there is this wonderful step-by-step, year-by-year process of the entire generational thing from Adam all the way to Noah. All the way to Noah. Now, here's what's important. In this process, God does two things in chapter 5 for us. He lays out for us specific year-by-year system so that we can do what I just did for you. We're not making this stuff up. It's right there. This many years went by. This many years. Read it sometime. It is absolutely fascinating. And take a pencil and write down all the years and calculate how it goes. It pans out perfectly. So we find out here that Adam and Eve have another kid. All right, his name is Seth. And as Seth is born, Eve says, Seth has replaced Abel for me. And out of Seth comes a generation of righteous people, okay? So Seth starts his generation, and we get here, and it says, from Adam to Noah, we run through this entire thing with all of these years. But something very interesting happens. During these years, it says in verse 32 of chapter 5, after Noah was 500 years old, he became the father of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Okay? So now, Noah is a father. But what has happened over this span of history? We're going from Adam, and we're spanning over to Noah. So let's just take a look at this. We are looking at a span of 1,056 years, okay? Now, 1,056 years, what's interesting about that particular span is this. Do you know how long Adam lived for? 930 years. How do we know that? Because it says, when God created, he created the male and female. When Adam had lived 130 years, he had his own sons and his own likeness. After Seth was born, Adam lived 800 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Adam lived 930 years, and then he died. So, Noah is 1,056 years after creation, right? How long between the death of Adam and the beginning of Noah? Thousands of years? No. Hundreds? No. I mean, we're talking about 930, so we're talking about just over 100 years, all right? So how many people, when Noah was born, were already hundreds of years old at that point? Many, okay, including Noah's dad, right? And so who did Noah's dad get to hang out with? It's not Adam, right? Right? Because you've got Noah's dad that's a couple hundred years old, and Noah's grandfather is a couple of hundred years old, and Adam who just died not a hundred and few years ago. And so you've got this entire generation. You have to understand in our context when we talk about 1,000 years, you're talking about so many generations passing that let's play telephone for a second. What if 1,000 years ago somebody told somebody something? And then over the last 1,000 years, generation for generation, the story was passed on, and but it wasn't written down. Where would we be now, right? Would we be able to assume that it's probably a whole new story? Yes, but what if we said 30 years ago or 50 years ago a story was told and my grandfather or my father who just passed away a year ago, all of his friends are still telling me the story. How accurate do you think that story is now? It's pretty darn accurate, right? So that's the context in which we're living. We have to take 1,000 years and we have to squish it down to about 40 years in our context. Because all of the people that hung out with Adam are still hanging out with Noah now. And so Noah's sons are hanging out with people that were hanging out with Adam and Eve. Are you with me? And so Adam's sons and daughters are still around and people are still around on the earth. So you're talking about a very interesting scenario coming here into chapter 6 because we're about to get into one of the most controversial chapters in the Old Testament, okay? There's a couple of these types of chapters and this is one of them. You know why it's controversial? Because guess what God's about to do? He's about to wipe out humanity. You go, okay, that's a little controversial, all right? The loving God of the New Testament. When he was back in the Old Testament, he was a mad, horrible God. Every time someone ticked him off, whoa, he'd wipe him out. I've heard that so many times, and they come right back to chapter 6 over here. Because chapter 6, some fascinating things begin to happen. At the end of chapter 5, think with me now, we are standing on a planet where number one, the people on the planet can touch tangibly people all the way back to the beginning. Are you with me? So that the stories and stuff are not thousands of years old. They're right there. They've got all the knowledge they need to make the kinds of decisions. Can you even imagine what Adam and Eve must have told everybody based on the fact that they had paradise and lost it? And that God had told them in paradise, you eat, you die. And after they did, they lost paradise, and then they began to watch their children kill each other, and they began to watch humanity go straight down the toilet. Can you imagine Adam looking around going, wow, he was right. And this is the kind of knowledge the people on the planet had, direct, specific knowledge. Not to mention that God shows up and talks to Cain, and there's no written word yet, so in terms of the Bible, so God is showing up, and he's talking to people. We also have reason to believe that the spiritual world and the physical world may have been tied together in a context that we can't understand because in the beginning of Genesis chapter 6, we find a very interesting and still very controversial little passage. Watch this. It says, in the beginning of chapter 6, when men began to increase in number on the earth and the daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful and they married them any of them they chose. Then the Lord said, my spirit will not contend with men forever, for he is mortal. His days will be 120 years. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterwards when the sons of God went to the daughters of men and had children by them. They were the heroes of old, the men of renown. The Lord saw how great men's wickedness on earth had become, and that every inclination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil all the time. The Lord was grieved that he had made man on the earth, and his heart was filled with pain. Let's take a quick look at this, all right? Who are these people? Who are the sons of God? Who are the daughters of men? What's happening over here? Well, let me just say this, and what I'm about to say to you guys is extremely important from here to the end of the Bible, okay? Because context is everything, all right? And if you don't get context, then you're going to get all over the place. Context also deals with purpose. God is going to reveal to us enough that we know what we need to know and we can make decisions wisely, and not enough that we get so confused that we have no idea what to do with it. So this is one of those moments. God comes in and he says this. Somewhere back before God realized that man had gone completely down the toilet, there were these sons of God and the daughters of men, and they came together. And these people were born of them, and these people that they call in here are known in the Bible as giants. They're giant men. The particular word here translated is actually the fallen in many ways. Now, who are these people? There are a couple of theories out there. I'm going to give them to you real quick, but it's not that important. Watch this. The first theory is this, that Cain, the descendants of Cain, are the sons, are the evil ones, and they are the ones that are called kind of the bad people. And then the daughters are from the tribes of good, and they came together, and then it was a mixture of good and evil. There's a lot of flaws in that and problems in that, but it makes some sense that possibly that's what it's talking about. The problem here, though, is that we've got the sons of God referring the rest of the Bible to angels, right? So now we're into some very interesting territory, because there is a possibility that angels were actually the sons of God looking down at men, and they found the woman beautiful, and they basically came down and procreated with woman. But now we're running into some problems, because in the New Testament, it tells us that angels in heaven, they don't procreate, and they're not married, and all that stuff doesn't happen, right? So angels can't exactly come down and do that, can they? Well, then we've got two scenarios happening here. One, we know that scripturally, there is the possibility of people, human beings, being taken over or possessed by demonic angels, basically fallen angels, right? So then there's a possibility that fallen angels basically took over men and then went and slept with women. Okay, so then, but you've got these people born that were known as men of renown, giants, if you will, and these people, so that means that somehow, whatever God created angels as and men as, if you're talking DNA and stuff, there might have been a tie there, and so it created these giants. Of course, another theory is that on the planet at this time, since God had created so many different things as human DNA and stuff, that certain human DNA was progressing faster than other human DNA in terms of sin, and so there were giant men and there were smaller men, and these were giant men, if you will, superheroes in some way, not that they had superhuman strength, but that they were big, that were the sons of God. In other words, people looked at them and went, wow, they're just, they must be blessed. You know, they're huge. And they slept with women from the ordinary people, and this particular thing progressed. Okay, now, what theory is probable? Well, they all three have certain flaws, and all three have certain validities, okay? But here's the deal. It is most likely that somehow angels are tied into this. Do we understand exactly how this played out? I mean, the Bible just simply leaves it at those few verses. It leaves it at that. It is likely that somehow angels are tied in, and that at this time in history, as angels and men were in a relationship that's different from now, that there was more tangible times because God met with men, that as they came together, that these fallen angels, the ones that God had cast down on the planet, were intent on destroying the line of God, humanity, because that's what sin and the evil forces that are around us spiritually want to do, is destroy. So they came in to destroy. Is any of that particularly important other than, wow, that's really interesting to the story? No, not really. What is important? What is God trying to tell us here? Two things that we get out of this particular part of the story. You ready? The first thing is this, that we know that, spiritually speaking, that God's interaction with man was in a context we can't possibly understand. God spoke directly to man. Perhaps the angels were involved with men in whole different ways. There is this world that we have to place ourselves into, because if we don't understand what happens next. If we just place our own context in there, we're gonna get lost. The other thing we have to understand is that whatever happened there, that was the part of this thing that God says, look at what happens to man. How many years are we into this now? Less than 1,000 years, right? And who's standing on the planet? The people that were around from the beginning. And who's interacting with them? God, the God of the universe, directly interacting with them. And what is man doing with all of that knowledge? What is humanity doing with all of that? Here's what humanity's doing. Humanity is turning their back from God, ignoring him, and starting to get involved in all sorts of wonderful do-it-my-way stuff. And you know what's happening to humanity? It is becoming so evil and so wicked that the process God is able to say in this chapter, and think about this for a second, imagine the God of the universe who can see the hearts of men is able to say that man had gotten so wicked that so many weird and horrible things were going on that God has to make a point to us today. There were this stuff going on and there were these people being born and it was getting really bad. And man had become so wicked and ignored me so much that at a certain point I could look at man and go, all they have in their hearts is wickedness now. In other words, listen very carefully to what I'm about to say. The process of sin that entered into the Garden of Eden when Adam and Eve ate of the fruit, God said that sin would do what? It would kill. And 1,000 years into the process, what has sin done? It has killed. Humanity has gotten so bad, so evil, and the mix of humanity and the demonic forces and everything have gotten so mixed up, and things have gotten so horrible that 1,000 years after the fall of man, man is about to self-destruct. Because that's what happens when you follow your way. Things look good for a while, but eventually it self-destructs and you destroy everything. Everything disappears. Noah is on the planet at this time, and God says in chapter 6 that there was this man, Noah, who was righteous. God does not tell us whether he made Noah righteous or whether Noah was righteous because he had relationship with God and he kind of developed in that sense. What we know is that God looked down at man and said, man is about to self-destruct. If I step out of the picture right now and go, I'm just going to let this go, the clock is ticking and man will wipe themselves out. Now that there's all these giants on earth and the stuff going on, and if we're right about the fallen angels sleeping with the woman of men by either becoming, because you know angels appeared in the Bible as men on several occasions throughout the Bible, so there's no reason that, or as humans anyways, there's no reason that we should assume that they might not be able to do that in some way, to be able to pull this off in that process. If we're right about that, things have gotten so ugly now in the mix that God has stepped back and said sin has now taken over. Sin has taken over the heart of man so much that they are going to kill themselves. And if they find Noah, they're going to kill him too. Because Noah will either fall into sin or they will kill anything that is good. And you know what's going to happen to man then? It's just a matter of time before they self-destruct. So you know what God does? Watch this. God does one of the most gracious things, in my opinion, that he's ever done in all of the Bible. God steps in and he says, here's what I'm going to do. Before man manages to self-destruct and kill itself, I am going to take a small piece, Noah and his family, and I'm going to take care of the rest quicker than it'll take care of itself. And I'm going to start from scratch before they destroy the little that they have left. How many of you have small children or have seen or been around small children or have babysat small children? Raise your hands if you've been around small children. Okay, if your hand isn't raised right now, come and see me afterwards. You need to be around small children for just a little while, okay? Here's the deal. When my kids are together, sometimes they get into it. You know, I know they're pastor's kids and it's not often that they fight. Actually, very rare. But... I'm kidding. They fight all the time. And it basically has become one of my jobs and my wife's jobs to determine at which point their fighting becomes so destructive that it is possible one of them is going to get seriously hurt, okay? Because if we try to break everything up at this point, that's all we'll do our whole entire life. Stay there. No, stop talking. No, hey, that's what, this is my life right here, okay? So I don't do that, okay? We just wait until it's at that point. We're like, oh, he pulled out. You know, Hope, my little daughter, her tendency right now at 3 years old, almost 3 years old, is to find any hard object and start swinging. That's what she does. So I just wait for it. I'm watching its fight and progressing. Hard object, run! And then you stop it and you're like, separation, and you pull them apart, right? In many ways, as a parent, what I'm doing on the teeny, tiniest little scale is what God is doing with humanity at this point. He's stepping in and going, you guys have, sin has ravished you so badly at this point that you are about to self-destruct. And so I'm going to start this from scratch. I'm going to take one man and I'm going to pull him out in his family, a righteous man, and I'm going to wipe out what humanity is in process of wiping out anyways. It's kind of like throwing chemotherapy into cancer. I mean, if you talk to anybody whatsoever and you said, there's a doctor and here's what he's going to do. He's going to shoot radiation through you. You're going to lose your hair, get really sick, throw up, and things are going to get bad. Your immune system's going to crash and you're practically going to die. I mean, we would go, somebody should sue that doctor. What are they doing? Are you out of your mind? I mean, doctors are supposed to help us, not supposed to hurt us. But the reality is that when there's purpose behind it, it makes sense, doesn't it? You go, oh, they're trying to save life by doing this. And that is exactly what God does here. He is saving humanity. Because without this move, without this flood, it was over. None of us are here. None of us are seated here. None of us know God. None of us ever came about because humanity destroyed itself thousands of years ago. But instead, God takes care of the problem. He removes Noah and his family, and he sends in a flood, and he wipes out the rest of man, and he puts Noah and his family on a special boat. Now, you've got to understand, the wickedness of men was amazing during this time, because in chapter 6, we find out about the boat, and you can imagine what's happening in this area. Noah is living in a time where God is able to say, man is wicked, period. I mean, horrible things are happening on the planet, right? Sin has taken over. Noah is righteous, and God comes to Noah and says, build a boat. Remember where they're living at this time. They're living right down there, you know, where the Tigris and Euphrates River come together and the Garden of Eden was. The entire surrounding area around that is kind of arid and desert. Remember, God told Adam and Eve, the soil is going to be tough from now on. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's no longer going to be easy. So they live in this place where it's probably rain and water and stuff like that is not a big deal. You know, there's a couple of rivers, and God comes to Noah and says, I want you to build a boat in your backyard, but I want you to make it really big. And Noah goes, how big? And God goes, here. And I mean, can you imagine Noah looking at the plans? This is going to take 10, I mean, this is 40, 50, 60, 70 years. God goes, yep, start building because the clock is ticking, water's coming. I mean, can you imagine when he was a quarter way into it, 10, 15, 20 years into it? Building. Noah, what are you building? Nothing. It's an odd-looking house. I know. Okay. You know, 40 years into it, Noah, what are you building? Nothing. It looks like a boat. It's not a boat. Do I look stupid? I mean, I don't know what Noah was thinking, folks, but to build a boat over all that period of time, it took Noah a long time to build the boat. While people are walking by, can you imagine when the boat was done, sitting on its side like this? You know, huge, massive boat, and Noah's busy packing food in. His family's packing food, and people are walking by. Noah, I see you built a boat. Yes. What are you doing? I'm packing. Why? The floods are coming. It's going to wipe all of you out. Have you guys ever heard that? I know people like that. You know, they're packing now. There's a hurricane coming in 2009. They're packing. They've got basements full of stuff. Not a bad idea, by the way. If you're one of those people that likes to pack, that's great. But this is a whole nother scale. This is a boat in the middle of a desert packed full of food. And then can you imagine the animals start showing up? And Noah's like, we're walking a man and getting all the animals situated. Walking by that boat, hearing all the animal noises all night? Are you kidding me? It must have been a weird time for humanity. They're evil. They're doing their thing. They're so caught up in what they're doing. You know, that stupid old Noah, let him build his stupid boat. And then one day in chapter 6, God opens the heavens and he opens the earth and water comes from everywhere. Must have been an unbelievable time. And Noah and his family are on the boat. And it must have grieved God's heart so much to have to do what he did, just like it grieves our heart at times when we have to do certain things to keep people from self-destructing, whether it's healing disease or separating our children. And God watches as the creation that sin entered into and started to destroy self-destructs. And the truth of his original promise is true. Humanity has destroyed itself. Now, very, very interesting thing happens. The flood occurs, and as the waters dry up and everything on the planet is wiped out, and that's a scientific thing we'll talk about one evening in the next few weeks, because the whole ark thing is a fascinating study in the scientific side of things. Noah and his family start, and this is what we find. This is unbelievable. In chapter 7 and in chapter 8 of Genesis, we find the beginning of the whole flood, and the Noah's family starts, and Noah's sons begin, and Noah's sons have sons, and well, Noah's daughter-in-laws have sons, and they begin to build this family. As this family begins to build, I'm going to jump a little bit now, okay? Read through chapter 8 and 9, because God makes covenants with Noah there that are unbelievable. After the flood, God comes to Noah and he says this to him: listen, here's the deal. Because you see, God knows what humanity is going to do now. You would think we're back to square one now, right? Noah knows the truth, so do his sons and his daughters-in-law. So they're going to get off the boat and they're going to start from scratch and they're going to build this thing. But is sin gone? No, sin is still there. It's just that sin has to start from scratch now again in many ways with Noah and his family. God already knows where this is going to go. So God says to Noah, listen, that is the one time I'm going to start this from scratch. From now on, there's other plans in place that we're going to take through, but I promise you, I will never bring floods and flood the earth again. That's not going to happen. So you guys start now, and you start building a world again. And so Noah begins with his sons, and they begin to build. And in chapter 9, we see the covenant that God makes and the sons of Noah. And then in chapter 10, the Table of Nations, it goes through and talks about Noah's sons and what each of them did. Very interesting Table of Nations when you start processing this. It's fascinating to watch what happens, because some of Noah's sons have sons and they travel down to Egypt. Some of them travel across the rivers and they go into the area what is known today as kind of modern day Iraq and all of that, and they go to the area that used to be Babylon. Some of them travel down into North Africa and they go to where today Ethiopia exists. And so you have these people kind of spreading across the land. One particular family that's very important is a family that travels down into North Africa, down into Egypt, into what is known today as Ethiopia. Okay, and in Ethiopia, one of the sons of one of the boys, okay, they travel down there, and he has a son. The Bible calls the son Nimrod. I want you to take a look with me real quick. Let's go to chapter 10. Okay. We're going to go down here, and we're going to go to verse 6. The sons of Ham, who was Ham? One of Noah's sons. The sons of Ham were Cush, Mizron, Put, and Canaan. Okay, Mizron, just so you know, was the son that traveled, his people traveled down to Egypt. Put, we don't know where he went. Canaan, obviously the land of Canaan was developed around there, so we know where they went. But Cush travels down to modern-day Ethiopia. The sons of Cush... okay, there's a list there of the sons of Cush, but go to verse 8. It says this: Cush was the father of Nimrod, who grew to be a mighty warrior on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. That is why it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. The first centers, it's kind of weird, I know. He was a mighty hunter. That's why they said he was a mighty hunter. Okay, good. It's kind of proof those days. It's kind of like archaeology, you know. We know he said that. That's why we know it's true. The first center of his kingdoms were Babylon, Erech, Akkad, and Calneh in Shinar. Okay, from that land he went to Assyria, where he built Nineveh, Rehoboth, Ir, Calan, and Rezin, which is between Nineveh and Calah. That is the great city. Okay, so you see what's happening here? Nimrod, important character. We're almost done here, folks, so hang with me for a few more seconds, okay? Nimrod is born from Cush down, probably by tradition and historical documentation we have, he was born down near in Ethiopia. His He's called Nimrod because the word Nimrod translated is rebellious one or rebellion, okay? So the Bible calls him Nimrod. By historical documentation, we don't think he was Nimrod. That was not his name because you'll notice he's not mentioned as one of the sons in here either. He became a great hunter or warrior, okay? In the Hebrew, when you look at this text, it's not translated great as in, woo, we're so proud of him. It's translated into conqueror. Same thing we would say of perhaps a Hitler. Okay, we would say, man, he was a great conqueror in his time. Yes, he was. He conquered massive sections. Wasn't a great man, just a great conqueror. All right. And so Nimrod here, called in the Bible rebellion one or hunter, okay, he is said to have come up and he starts conquering. He conquers in Babylon. He conquers up into Assyria. He builds a place called Nineveh, which later on becomes famous because of another person we'll talk about later on. And Nineveh was not a happy place. And so in Babylon, when he gets to Babylon, he's traveled all the way up and he's probably traveled through kind of the Egyptian areas where they're building all these interesting things. Now, at this time, again, we've gone through a couple of hundred years, all right? Noah and his family are still around, their grandparents, and Nimrod starts moving up, and guess what he does? This is what he does. In chapter 11 of Genesis, a fascinating thing begins to happen. Nimrod gets to Babylon, and we don't know absolutely for sure the history of this, but we've got bits and pieces from archaeology and from tablets and from things. Nimrod begins the process of building. It says he became the first emperor in the Bible. It says he became the first emperor. And what does an emperor do? He leads people. People follow him, right? And so he gets to Babylon, and in chapter 11, we find this wonderful story where the people united begin to build a tower. And they say, we're going to build this tower so we can connect to the heavens and so that we can make a name for ourselves. From all of the evidence that we have, it makes most sense at this time that Nimrod has a following. He's conquered these massive areas. He has started a whole new form of religion. And he's got everyone together, and he says, we're going to build this temple, and we're going to worship the gods on this temple, and we're going to take this temple, and it's going to make a name for ourselves. He was considered to be somebody who was to be worshipped because the religion that he started worshipped the emperor and worshipped the gods of the stars and all these different people. And so Nimrod comes along, gets all the people together, and starts building this temple. And look what happened, folks. We don't know the exact time that the Tower of Babel was built, but we do know that it was sometime before Abraham and sometime after the flood. In that little stretch of time, they begin to build a tower. And you know what God does? Can you imagine God standing going, wow, this is amazing. I mean, the progression of sin is an amazing thing to watch, isn't it? I mean, it progresses things so bad that God has to wipe out humanity in order to start from scratch because humanity has self-destructed. And then it begins right after that, and it begins translating back into walk away from God. And at a certain point, when you get to the end of God, look what happens. God has the Tower of Babel being built, and God comes down and he says, enough. And instead of allowing Nimrod to start an entire kingdom, God takes humanity and he separates them out. He allows them to all speak different languages. And the Bible says to us in chapter 11 that man scattered across the face of the earth at that point because they couldn't understand each other. Can you even imagine the Tower of Babel, what must have been happening? I mean, you've got all these people building this amazing temple and they're all working together. And suddenly, in a moment, you know, you're walking next to your friend and you're carrying a brick and he's carrying a brick and you turn around and you start speaking to him and he looks at you and he goes, what are you doing, man? And he looks, what are you doing? No, and they suddenly start realizing as they're trying to communicate that they don't understand a word. So the one guy thinks the other guy's being funny, and this guy thinks that guy's being funny. I mean, you get it? Because I understand myself just fine. I still think I'm speaking my language. You know what I mean? It's not like suddenly I'm speaking, whoa, what just came out of my mouth? I'm speaking. It's just coming out sounding really different to him. And so suddenly all these people are in total chaos and they start, and what do humans do that have sin in their lives? As soon as we're different, what do we do, folks? We look at the people that aren't like us and we go, you're weird. And so we find the people that are just like us and we crowd with them and they say, aren't they weird? Yes, we're not weird. Let's go live over there, away from them. And so people start spreading out. The tower comes down. Nimrod's kingdom is destroyed. And then humanity begins to spread itself out. Now, at the point that this happened, again, Nimrod had started this whole religious following of all these gods. So all these people with all these different languages start spreading out all over the place, and they become nations. And it's called the Table of Nations. And as they spread out and they become nations in this story, can you imagine some of the confusion that must have been in these nations, where they've got pieces and bits of Noah's story and the flood and God's story, because they're still close to that, but they've got Nimrod who taught them all the stuff, and they've got all this mixes, and so they travel all over, and each group starts its own form of little stuff. And so God begins the process to say, all right, I need to step into this, and I need to begin to reveal myself to the planet, because my goal is still the same from the beginning. To have a love relationship with man. But sin is on a rampage right now. Destroying, destroying, destroying. And so this is what happens. In chapter 11, God decides at the end of chapter 11 and the beginning of chapter 12 that he is going to take out of all these nations, he is going to start a nation. And he's going to separate that nation out. And he's going to have this nation become the demonstration of what happens when you do it God's way. And out of that nation, he's going to show the world his grace and his mercy and his love. He's going to show the world what he's done and show the world that if you follow me, it leads to life. And if you don't, it leads to destruction. The same thing he told Adam and Eve, the same thing he told Cain, the same thing he told Noah, the same thing he told the people after Noah, the same thing he told everyone up to that point, and the same thing he's going to be telling us for the rest of the Old Testament, into the New Testament, and throughout the New Testament. And you know what? Here's the deal. As we look at the first part of God's story, Genesis chapter 1 through Genesis chapter 11, and we look at 2,000 years spanning from Adam to Noah and the flood, from Noah and the flood to Nimrod and the Tower of Babel, from Nimrod and the Tower of Babel, all the way to Abraham and the birth of Abraham, 1,056 years after creation. In 2001 BC, Abraham is born, and Abraham will become, as you will see in the next part of the story, the beginning of God's grace to a nation that will become God's grace to us. And it is through that nation that God will bring in a Savior, and through that Savior that God will bring us to himself, and through that that we would have a relationship with him. So with all of this going on, if there was one thing, if there was one point, if there was a single thought that we could say, what difference does all this make to us? For me, it's very simple. It comes down to a single fact that God's grace has been the same from day one as it is now, and this is it. He keeps saying this to us over and over again. Listen, this love relationship you have with me is all about trust. I promise you, if you do it my way, it leads to life. It always does. It leads to paradise. Where paradise began, just the way it should have been, that's where it ends again if you follow me. But if you do it your way, it leads to destruction and death. Nothing's changed in all of history. It's still the same message. Same message it was to Adam and Eve. Can you imagine, like I said before, what Adam and Eve's life must have been like, watching for 930 years as sin did its work, and how they must have thought back to the day that God said to them, do it my way, and it'll lead to life. Do it your way, and it'll lead to death. And they didn't believe him. They didn't take him up on his promise. They didn't trust him. And because they didn't trust him, everything changed. Sin destroyed. And I want to tell you guys, I'm discovering in my own life, year after year after year, that the more I'm willing to trust God's ways, God's principles, and the things God tells me, the more I'm willing to trust when God tells me what to do and how to do it, and I'm willing to do it despite the fact that it doesn't make a whole lot of sense, or despite the fact that my head is telling me he's just trying to limit you. He's just trying to rob you of joy. He's just trying to take away the stuff that's fun. The more I'm willing to say that's baloney and I do it his way, the more my life turns into freedom. But the more every time I decide to do it my way, every time I decide not to trust him, I watch the destruction of sin, not immediately, but over time. For Adam, it took 930 years to see humanity destroy itself. For us, we don't have 930 years, do we? But you take 5 years of your life, or 10, do it your way, see what happens. Do it God's way, see what happens. That's what God's trying to say all the time. My grace is giving you a way to do it my way, so that you don't have to face the destruction that they faced before the flood and that they faced after, and that humanity still faces today. God is so gracious, and it must have grieved him and hurt him badly to do the things he's had to do all this time to all of us, including watching his son die, so that we have a chance to be with him again. Let's pray. God, I just want to thank you so much that despite the fact that we don't always understand what you did and how you did it and what you're up to, that we don't always understand how everything played out exactly in the details. God, I thank you that despite the fact that we don't understand what was happening before the flood exactly, that we know this, that you show us plain and clear that from the moment you created us, from the moment we started to live and breathe and have relationship with you, that there has been a call to trust you. And every time we have stepped out of that call and stopped trusting you and started trusting ourselves, our own ideas, our own thoughts, our own ways, it has always led us into death and destruction. And I just pray, God, right now, that for all of us sitting here as we unfold your story, that we would be acutely aware of one thing, that you are not out to limit us or to rob us of joy or to steal away from us the life that is good life, but that the very opposite is true, that you are out to see that we have freedom and life when we follow you. I pray, God, that as we watch Adam and Eve and the actions they took, and we watch humanity and the actions it took after sin entered the world, and we watch the Tower of Babel, and then we watch the nation of Israel, and then we watch from the time you came to this planet in the flesh to now, and we watch what sin does, that we would run from it, and that we would do it your way, so that we can have life. Thanks for your story, God. We just worship you now for your grace and mercy in our lives. In Jesus' name, amen. Mm-hmm.